You may be an ambassador to England or France. You may like to gamble. You might like to dance. You may be the heavyweight champion of the world. You may be a socialite with a long string of pearls. But you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, indeed, you're gonna have to serve somebody. Well, it may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Maybe a rock and roll addict prancing on the stage. Money, drugs at your command, women in a cage. You may be a businessman or some high degree thief. They may call you doctor or they may call you chief. You're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, you are. You're gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
Well, it may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
You may be a state trooper. It may be a young Turk. Maybe the head of some bigger TV network. You may be rich or poor, you may be blind or lame, maybe living in another country under another name, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, you are.
That's right, and you decide. This is the Peace and Justice Program. My name is Chris. The Peace and Justice Program is on every Friday from 11:30 to 1 here on your community radio station, KZFR. And I have on the line with me a friend who describes himself as an Iowa-based peace activist, which covers a lot of territory, I can tell you. And we wanted to talk today about a number of things. And probably, Brian Terrell, I should start by saying hi. Hello, are you on the line with me?
Hello, Chris, yes.
Yeah, thank you for being with me today. You have been a busy person. I don't know if we should work backwards or forwards or sideways, but you had an article that you published yesterday, I think, came out in Common Dreams. Why don't we start with there and then kind of work backwards? Can you tell us about this article? I'm trying to get to it. Anyway, about your most recent article in Common Dreams. God, I have so many pieces of paper, Brian. It's okay. Embarrassing. Well, go ahead.
Yeah, I just heard the other day, it's hard to keep track of everything going on with the drone technology, but in these last days, this last 10 days of bombing in Gaza, Israel is very proud of itself. They think it's a very humane and decent thing and moral thing to do when they've destroyed some of these buildings, you know, including, you know, one 13-story apartment complex. They have a method they call roof knocking. And they have a drone that fires a missile that doesn't have a warhead, and all it's meant to do, and they hit the roofs of buildings with this, and it's meant to shake it up and to warn people to leave the building, and then they also will call the people that they can get a hold of and just say, I hope you're having a good day. I hope everything's okay. We're gonna bomb your house in 5 minutes, get out. And they say that this means that what they're doing is not a crime, and it shows their commitment to human life. And I see this as the drone technology. I was part of the first protests in 2009 at Creech Air Force Base of the Reaper and Predator drones being flown out of there in Nevada by remote control all over the world. Is consistently they use it as a humane and decent, more limited thing to do. President Obama bragged about the drone program, about we can narrowly target the people who want to do us harm and with the least amount of damage to civilians, even though at the time he knew, was already told that less than 10% of the victims of U.S. drone attacks are intended targets. And even the intended targets are civilians by international law. So, and as it's creeping into police departments, the police departments now that are getting drones are using the same thing in response to the killings of George Floyd and so many other people of color, and so many calls of defunding and reforming the police. Police departments are responding and saying that their drones are intended to de-escalate potential violent situations as a way to make closer relations between the police and the community. And it's just absurd. Those who are the victims of the drones in Gaza and Afghanistan, in our cities now, along the border, these are instruments of racism and terror. They're insult to injury, but it makes the people who make them and the people who use them and the citizens who pay for it and vote for these politicians, it eases the consciences of those people to say, as the Israelis are saying, as they blow up buildings, we're doing this in the most humane and kind and gentle way possible. And actually this makes war and repression, because it's that much easier and that much easier to stomach and that much easier to sell to voters and taxpayers. It makes it all the more likely and all the harder to retract from.
I'm speaking with Brian Terrell, and he has an article in Common Dreams called The Myth of the Benevolent Drone, Kinder, Gentler, Safer Way to Wage War. From the 20th. And then on the 16th, you had your second webinar on killer drones. This is part of a new campaign that you are involved in after the demise of the group that you had been with for years called Voices for Creative Nonviolence. You've started up a new group called Ban Killer Drones in April with peace activists and Veterans for Peace also. In this group, I know in this particular one, you were talking about the proliferation of drone warfare, whistleblowers, and border surveillance, as well as activism. Can you talk a little bit about your webinar series, Brian Terrell?
Okay, well, this is the second one, and you can see our website is bankillerdrones.org. And this is an international effort. Two of the people in our webinar last week were from the UK, and we're working with the people in other parts of the world as well. The time has come that we need to speak out and just to say that these use of drones by the military and by the police for surveillance, for crowd control, for all of this, it needs to be banned. And it's only a part of this. We are working toward a international protocol, like for use for landmines, with a very recent prohibition on the use of nuclear weapons. But we realize that this is just a step, just as with the nuclear weapons. We have the United Nations treaty that has been ratified and has come into effect with more than 51 countries signing on, but none of the nuclear countries have signed on. And it's a tool that many anti-nuclear activists are using around the world to push for the elimination of nuclear weapons. But we know that that's something that's not going to be decided in the UN or in the legislature. It's going to be pressure from the people in the streets is where the real political power is. So we're using that as a tool and a way to reach people what we're mainly working at now, as my article from yesterday, is just So many people are buying this idea that it's possible to have a war and it's possible to control people in the streets who are rising up, and it's possible to, you know, even drones are being used in labor disputes. And the argument there, again, is it's safer than using police on the streets. There's not a nice way to do these things. We shouldn't be doing them at all. You know, the bombing of Gaza, the horror of it was not reduced one little bit because drones with unarmed missiles were thumping on the roofs of buildings where people were living. Oh, that was terrorizing. That's a part of the terror and a part of the horribleness of war. It's not an antidote. It's not a, you know, and there isn't any antidote to these things.
Right.
There isn't a way that we can fight a war. There isn't a way that we can control labor disputes. There isn't a way that we can control violence in the streets and not even use the violence, but control crowds of people who are angry and rising up in the streets without addressing the root causes of those things. There's no technological fix. There's no weapon that we're going to come up with on the drawing board. You know, no matter how high tech it is, and it's in all the fiber optics and GPS and, you know, high resolution video and everything, you know, violence is violence, and it's not going to solve anything.
Yeah, you know, you've been under quarantine there on your farm in Malloy, Iowa, and you put out a newsletter with your Catholic worker friends and family that live there. Mm-hmm. And the article from April 19th was called Biden's Drone Wars. And you talked about a New York Times article on April 15th that posted an article that said how the U.S. plans to fight from afar after troops exit Afghanistan. And you talk about a bait and switch there, and I know you're very deeply connected from Afghanistan after many, many trips there, and you have many friends there. Can you talk about what you meant by a bait and switch tactic that President Biden's going to be using?
Yes, well, that was just recently, you know, in the course of 2 days, one day, President Biden announced that all the troops are going to be out of Afghanistan, and the next day there's a clarification to say that the support for the Afghan government is going to continue, and that there will be that the use of drones and the word he used was that the ongoing anti-terror tactics of the United States and having our in Afghanistan are going to continue, and that's drones and that's special forces. That's not going to be affected at all. In fact, apparently it's going to be increased. And interestingly, that came, you know, back in just after in February, President Biden made the same announcement about Yemen, saying that the United States is not going to support the Saudi and UAE war against Yemen anymore, and again the day, you know, saying that the war is a humanitarian disaster and it's a crime and it has to end. And, you know, the next day the same thing happened. The clarification is that offenses against Al-Qaeda and ISIS will continue, and that's again with the drones. And I think what we're seeing is, just as President Obama was really made drone warfare the really the key up to his foreign policy, so now Biden is taking it further and saying, you know, it's not going to be, you know, we're not going to be have so many boots on the ground, but we're going to be fighting this at long distance, and, you know, through drones by remote control. And this is a very attractive thing to a politician, because the only thing that makes war unpopular, unfortunately, with the American public is the body bags coming back and the victims, American victims, and this illusion that we can have, you know, a war, loveless war. Well, first, it's impossible. It can't happen. But the illusion is one that is going to be, as much as we accept that illusion, we're going to be driven deeper and deeper into more and more intractable wars.
Yeah. And, you know, somebody asked you in an interview, and I'll go ahead and ask it too, because this seems so obvious to us that this technique of killing people, extrajudicial killing 9 out of 10 that are civilians, destroying people's livelihoods, their little homes, their farms, this is all going to come back to us in the form of what we call terrorism, but anyway, it's a retribution. And so who in the government, military, diplomatic, or intelligence communities supports our position that drones are not a deterrent to terrorism?
I don't know, but there are plenty of people who are no longer in those positions. The list is almost endless. It's actually, he was still in the Obama administration, but Stanley McChrystal, who is the general who is in charge of U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan, was fired from his position after he spoke to Rolling Stone magazine. I think it was 2013, where he said, you know, he gave us the number that we're creating for every person we kill with these methods, we're creating 10 new enemies. You know, many people who've left the CIA and left the military, former diplomats from the United States and the UK. When people leave, they're very critical of it. But when they're in office, they're in their jobs, they know what happened to Stanley McChrystal. And so they keep the company alive. But the cost is there's of course the danger of you know, attacks in the United States. I forget which year it was. I happened to be in New York for a special session on nuclear disarmament when there was a bomb scare in Times Square. And you know, fortunately, some bystanders noticed something, a bomb that could have gone off if they hadn't intervened. And the man who was caught, who admitted planting this bomb, he said this was in response. It's from Pakistan. Man from Pakistan, and his was in response, he said, to the drone attacks, and also the damage. I think that our politicians are very, very cynical when they say that this is that there's no damage to our, no threat to our soldiers. And of course, a soldier, an airman in Creech Air Force Base in Nevada, or at Syracuse, New York, or in Des Moines, Iowa, who's sitting at a computer screen watching things on the ground and shooting missiles is not going to be captured or hurt, is not even going to miss a meal or miss sleeping in their own bed or miss a shower or any of the, they're not being mistreated or hear any loud noises. However good the video is, there's no sound.
Yeah.
The drones, but we're seeing tremendous moral injury for these soldiers. One of the ironies is the very fact that they can't be hurt, that they are killing people who cannot possibly be any kind of threat to them, makes the guilt of pulling that trigger and launching that missile all the greater. And also the fact that these young men and women who are doing this they have an intimacy with their victims that nobody else has had in modern warfare since hand-to-hand combat, because they're seeing, you know, the people who are launching mortars or the people who are dropping bombs. They don't see up close what they're doing. A jet fighter can be miles away by the time the missile they fire hits the ground, and they're not going to even see the plume of smoke from that missile. But the drone operator, the drones go very, very slow. They circle around and they survey the damage, and they see our service people will see family members and first responders trying to pick up all the pieces of their murdered neighbors and relatives, loved ones. And very, very often they're ordered to, you know, they call it a double tap, to shoot at those people, because who would be coming to the help of a terrorist but another terrorist? So the very fact that somebody is coming to the aid, or even trying to respectfully deal with the corpses and the body parts, you know, that makes somebody suspect as well. And you know, these are people who are, the military is finding this as a job that nobody wants to do.
Right.
And
it's terrible.
The war comes home. We cannot fight a war that's going to be kept over there. It's not possible. It's in one way or another, it comes home to us, and we have to get rid of war.
Right. So I have time for one more question. I'm going to ask you, I'm going to quote you, and then I'm going to ask you. You say, long ago, both George Orwell and President Eisenhower foresaw today's forever wars and warned of nations, industries, economies, and politics becoming so dependent on the production and consumption of armaments that wars would no longer be fought with an intention of winning them, but to ensure that they never end, that they are continuous. And that's what we're in now. And I'd like you to, again, tell us what our listeners can be doing. This is only going to end if the people end it. Thank you, Brian Terrell. Tell us what we need to do.
Oh, well, I think we need to, you know, to speak out, speak to our neighbors. I actually think it's because politicians are not usually, very rarely are they courageous people, that they respond only to mass movements. It might be more, at least as important, to talk to your neighbors and the people you work with or go to school or church with, as it is to contact your elected officials. Well, that should be done. I think you get in the street, make noise, go to military bases. DL Air Force Base, not far from you, is one of the places where the Global Hawk drone is flown, and there's a very good community that's been protesting there on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
Some people don't pay their taxes and tell the government why. I think it's like what Dr. King said during the Vietnam War. He said he gave nobody an alibi. He said everyone must protest. Everyone must find the way that suits them, suits their condition and their abilities and their talents and their temperament. Everyone must do it in their own way, but everyone must. I think if everybody you know should know where you stand on these things, that I think that's really essential. That our positions, that we not just keep our fears and objections quietly to ourselves, but that we find some ways to speak them. To you do it on a radio show. Teachers do it in the classroom. Some people do it by blocking the roadway into a base. There's all kinds of ways to do it. There isn't one right way to do it. Just get out there and make sure that your voice is heard.
Yeah. Oh, that's true. And, you know, in loving memory of 230 Gazans and 12 Israelis, this insanity has to stop. I mean, I think it's really time, and I'm really glad to hear that you're working on international convention to ban killer drones, and I hope people will go to bankillerdrones.org and continue with your work to close Guantanamo and everything else you're doing, Brian Terrell. Folks can follow him just by typing in his last name spelled T-E-R-R-E-L-L, and I will link to some of the things he's involved in. Thank you so much for being with us on the Peace and Justice program today, Brian. Stay well.
Okay, thank you, Chris.
All right, bye-bye. I want to thank our underwriters, first of all, for this segment of the Peace and Justice program. And I just hope it's helpful to you to learn these things and to hear these things, and that it doesn't make you just kind of go, oh, and pull the wool over your eyes and the covers over your head, because this is our future. The city of Chico has bought drones to surveil. Next time, you know, turn around, they'll be weaponized. It's scary, but it's also, I mean, it's a Pandora's box, right? It's just going to open more and more and more. So we absolutely have to nip it. It's up to us. So the Peace and Social Justice Program is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Chico Natural Foods Cooperative, offering a variety of organic and local produce, organic groceries, and supplements. The co-op has hot food, ready-to-eat sandwiches, and cold brew coffee. The co-op now accepts online orders for curbside pickup. Chico Natural Foods Co-op is open every day on the corner of 8th and Main in downtown Chico. And Chico Velo, supporting bicycling, education, and advocacy since 1980. The Wildflower returned this April 24th, and that was a good thing. And if you want to see more about that, go to Wildflower Adventure Visit. WildflowerCentury.org. And it is just a few minutes shy of the top of the hour, so I'll make a couple of announcements here. We talked about the situation in Gaza a little bit. There's going to be the peace vigil at 3rd and Main. Will be from 12:30 to 1:30 on Saturday. It will focus on Gaza. We don't know how long the ceasefire will last. And we want to end the occupation and to have justice for Palestine. And so it's always part of our messaging. But students will also be involved. They're going to start at 3rd and Flume at 12:30, and you can march with them to 3rd and Main. I think they're going to join us and bring your own sign, or we have some also. So I hope you'll be able to do that. And let's see, another thing that's happening is got a note from Women's Health Specialists. They're having a fundathon trivia night on the 28th at 6:30. Go to their Facebook page, Women's Health Specialists. And the Chico Climate March is today. Well, I think they're going to do that First Fridays thing that is happening in Washington and around the country. So it's at 3:30 today. Starts at the Children's Park. Assembles there at 3:30, and then they're going to march to City Hall. So if you feel like a walk today, that would be a good way to walk it. One of the stats I kind of carry around with me, if I can find it here, I think is important to realize regarding that. Nope. Doesn't want to jump out at me anyway. Here it is. The Biden budget would send $1.3 billion more to Israeli military than to global climate programs this year. So it's very, very, very important to reassign our priorities here in this country. And I would like to thank my next set of underwriters. Those would be the Regional and Continuing Education at Chico State, offering online graduate test preparation courses for those seeking an advanced degree in a wide range of fields, including law and business. Sign up for a complimentary strategy session to help you prepare to take the GRE, the GMAT, the LSAT, and that would be at rce.csuchico.edu. And also, I want to thank Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, family-owned, operated, and argued over since 1980, reminding listeners to think for themselves but drink with others. And stay tuned after this program for Playing Dead. Your Friday starts up in the kickback style of Playing Dead, followed by Devastation Sounds with Sanjay. So let's go ahead. Oh, you know, when I came in, I was going to say something I didn't. Bob Dylan is going to turn 80 years old in 2 days. So that's why I played that Bob Dylan song, Gotta Serve Somebody. Besides just the content of the song, it's just to celebrate an incredible person that's had such a marked influence on at least my generation. Amazing man. So it's 12 o'clock straight up. This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Let's have a little forward promote here from one of the things the station is doing.
This is the COVID
Nope, not that one.
KZFR in
Sorry.
Chico.
Got the wrong one. Let's see if I can get it to switch out. Sometimes this thing is a little sluggish in terms of switching. Doesn't want to switch. Stop. Let's see if it'll... I'm going to just try one more time. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. Here we go.
The Noise Filter Podcast.
Nope. Okay. I'm going to put a song on for you. A little David Rovix, looks like. Here we go.
You can say you are a man of the people, and you have our interests in mind. You can say you stand with the working class, and you would march on our picket lines. You can say you're with the underdogs, not the billionaires on Wall Street. And you look so earnest as you shake the hands of all the good people you meet, but you don't fool me. No, you don't fool me. You can call yourself a man of action. You can say we've got to make haste. You can talk so convincingly about all the hazards we face. You can blather on about green jobs with nukes and natural gas. You can reminisce about your youth and the time that you smoked some grass. But you don't fool me. No, you don't fool me. You can say you are a man of peace. You can talk like you know the score. Yeah, if you were in the Senate at the time, you would have voted against the war. You can say that every drone strikes a blow for liberty. You can claim this is not an empire. You just want everyone to be free. But you don't fool me.
No.
No, you don't fool me. You can make a speech about hope and change. You can bring us all to tears. You can list all your accomplishments, say give us four more years. You can make the case your party is so different from the other. You can say you've got my back. You can call yourself my brother, but you don't fool me.
Okay. I think that song makes a point. All right, so this is Chris. The show is Peace and Justice. This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico. Listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond, if I didn't say that already. I have on the line with me a person that has got me reading the last few days. I have reams of articles and papers and just trying to catch up with him. He's had over 30 years in the field of elder justice, and he is Eric Carlson, a nationally known expert on nursing facility issues and consumer rights. He sat on the Commission for Safety and Quality in Nursing Homes, for Safety and Quality in Nursing Homes, a federal commission that was called during the pandemic. Eric has broad experience in many forms of long-term services and supports, including home and community-based services, nursing facility care, and assisted living facilities. He led Justice and Aging's extensive research funded through the Commonwealth Fund on Medicaid-funded assisted living, and currently is leading a project to assist consumer advocacy on Medicaid managed called LTSS, Long-Term Services and Supports, in Florida and New Jersey. He counsels attorneys from across the country and co-counsels litigation on consumers' behalf. Mr. Carlson serves as president of the National Assisted Living Consumer Alliance and is the author of the legal treatise Long-Term Care Advocacy. And his organization is called Justice in Aging, and it ensures that residents' advocates know how to fight for their clients' rights, pushes Congress and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which we will be referring to as CMS, to pass and enforce laws to protect residents, and serves as an important national voice on common nursing home issues and what's needed to improve them. Welcome, Eric Carlson, to the Peace and Justice Program.
Thanks. My pleasure to be here.
Yeah, so I care deeply about this issue because of COVID and all the people that we lost during COVID, and I wanted to get you on the air, and I didn't really realize what I was getting into. There's so much to know. Let's just start at the beginning here. Many of our listeners may not think much about the concerns of elderly people in care settings. It's definitely an out of sight, out of mind situation, unless you or your family members have been involved in it, if you've witnessed a tragedy of people trapped by their circumstances who were not able to get out, not be able to have their families with them. So now the pandemic is waning and our collective sights are moving forward, and I wanted to look back just a little bit to honor those who passed and also shed some light on assisted living facilities and nursing homes, and that's why I asked Eric to be with us today. You've done this, as I mentioned, for over 30 years, worked in elder law and been a leader around the country. You wrote an extremely helpful collection of information called The 25 Common Nursing Home Problems and How to Resolve Them. And these are problems of poor care, evictions, funding, billing issues, and denial of residents' rights. And it didn't start with the Trump administration. I'm sure that we should all know that. But you wrote that the majority or a plurality of nursing homes are in a state of constant noncompliance despite many federal regulatory requirements. Eric Carlson, can you explain some common violations in case people aren't familiar with these places?
Sure, absolutely. First, I'll make the plug that the guide you referenced is on the Justice in Aging website for free. So 25 common nursing home problems and how to resolve them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's written to address exactly the problem that we're talking about here. Just ongoing noncompliance. A lot of nursing facilities are just mediocre to the core, and they have standard operating practices that are inconsistent with the law, such that residents don't have much control over what they do during the day. They don't have choices in routine daily things. They may be evicted inappropriately. They don't get necessary assistance. They don't get the kind of rehabilitation assistance that they might need in order to improve their physical functioning or their mental functioning. Just in general, very mediocre care that does the bare minimum, but that doesn't do much beyond that. And there's a couple reasons for that. One is probably the regulatory issue. You'd want the survey agencies to be more aggressive and energetic and to assess fines for continuing noncompliance. And I think beyond that, there's also just some systemic problems in how nursing facilities are dealt with by all of us. There's just not enough pressure on them. And I think that's true at the resident, from the resident's perspective, the family's perspective, and also the perspective of the so-called aging network. Yeah, hospital discharge planners, social workers, other people. We've all haven't pushed hard enough, and our expectations have maybe been too low, and we've let nursing facilities continue in a very slipshod way. The better nursing facilities these days talk about a culture change, within the facilities and the whole environment, where the nursing facility staff works harder to meet residents' needs and to address those individual needs. Another term that's often related to that that's often put out there is person-centered care, which is considered the gold standard. So the operations of the nursing facility are not driven by standard operating procedures, the way they've always done things, administrative convenience, but it's driven by what individual residents want, which is right. And when I counsel people, I always tell them to be aggressive in a nice way, I think, in most cases, but nonetheless aggressive, and to not be embarrassed for asking for something. Instead, have a healthy sense of entitlement. Again, the entitlement in the best sense of the word, thinking this nursing facility is getting paid by me or by Medicaid or Medicare or somebody thousands of dollars a month. I should get something for that. I should get some attention for that. I should have my preferences honored for that amount of money and for the regulations that require that level of attention. That's what nursing facilities should be doing, and residents shouldn't be hesitating in asking for that level of attention.
Right. And from the workers' perspective, these are understaffed and undertrained and burnt out people that provide this care with some of the most difficult patients, people who have strokes or cognitive declines. And there's precious little professional staff. They're mainly giving medications and not really providing care. So why doesn't the government watchdog group called CMS, or Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, do a better job with regulating these places? I mean, you're talking about quality of life, but in many circumstances, people are actually being harmed in these places. And the type of harms might be like bed sores or falls, all kinds of injuries, you know. Can you talk about CMS and why is there such a lag in terms of them being able to do their job?
Yeah, of course. Let me first just try to draw the right line in the middle of this for your listeners, that I think it's important to balance a couple of things. One is that there's definite deficiencies in the system, right? Facilities aren't as good as they can be. But I also don't want to communicate woe is to those who enter the nursing facilities, right? There's a middle ground where we have to recognize their problems, but it's not hopeless either. Mm-hmm. And also to recognize there's some as you pointed out, workers who are working really hard, particularly in the last year and a quarter, under really difficult circumstances, obviously. So I want to recognize all that and keep that in mind. That being said, one of the things that's necessary for a healthy nursing facility system is the sort of enforcement that you mentioned. The federal government sets the standards for this, and then individual states then are responsible for doing the surveying. So it's public health in California that physically surveys the nursing facilities and is responsible to a great extent, with participation by CMS as well, in selecting the fines. And it's limited. The system oftentimes is limited by the fact that penalties aren't assessed unless there's a finding of what CMS and the state or survey agencies characterize as harm. But harm is oftentimes read in a too limiting way. That means unless somebody's bleeding or has broken bone, unless there's this demonstrable physical injury, it's not considered worthy of a penalty. And so that allows a lot of bad behavior to continue. You can treat people poorly, in a variety of ways, and violate the standard of care without a penalty being assessed because there's not that demonstrable physical harm. And so that allows problems to fester, and that allows the continuation of what I earlier described as thoroughly mediocre care.
Right.
What you need is you need a message that says this is not good enough, right? It's not good enough.
Right.
It just can't continue.
So there, in 2008, there was a push for private equity funds to buy up nursing homes, and now about 70% are for profit, and so they have a big incentive to cut staffing and amenities of different types. And there's been a 1-to-5-star system that I was referred to called Nursing Home Compare. And when I went to that site, I was very impressed by what I kind of knew as one good assisted living facility here in our community, and then others around here that had lower star rates. And this star system is simple, and it takes into account staffing and quality of care metrics. But I think it's important for people to understand it a little better if they ever have to look up a care home for their family, in terms of what the stars mean, in terms of how much you pay, and are you getting what you pay for, and also about what happened during COVID in light of this star system. Can you talk about your concerns and criticisms of it?
Sure. It's an important topic. Just a quick background. The federal government has a Care Compare website that includes not just nursing facilities, nursing homes, but also home health agency, hospices, and others. So you go on the internet, I think it's carecompare.gov, and Nursing Home Compare is a piece of that. You're asked to type in the care setting that you want to look at. And so what you get, a lot of information, the penalty history, the deficiency information, inspection history, rather, of that nursing facility, for example. And then, as you mentioned, and various quality measures, which are information about the resident population, which includes things like the use of antipsychotic medications or the prevalence of bed sores or whether people have declined under certain circumstances or lost weight. And then summarizing this whole package of information is this 5-star system that you mentioned. The facility gets 1 to 5 stars based on deficiencies and the staffing levels that they've shown and a certain subset of those quality measures. So I think it's helpful to look at this. I would just give a warning. I don't want to just automatically assume, oh, 5 stars, everything's fine. I think I'll go to this place. It's information, but it's not determinative or shouldn't be determinative. In part because I think it's harder to rate things like nursing facility care. I know we're accustomed to stars. I think it's easier to do that when you're rating cars or washing machines or something like that.
Movies.
Right, you've got a physical product that's made with certain specifications, but nursing home care is a much more fluid thing. And so just my message to the listeners is that it's useful information, but it should be a starting point rather than an end point. It's still, and if you get a place that's a 1-star or that's got a is recognized as a facility that has a history of abuse, that's probably a message to be careful or maybe to just completely rule that facility out. But even if you are looking at places that have 4 and 5 stars, you need to look behind that. Sometimes the 4 and 5 stars is just a product of these self-reported quality measures, which are subject to some gaming. I think one of the very most critical things in looking for a facility is talking to them and asking questions that are relevant to you as the incoming resident, or if you're calling for a family member, things that are important to them, right? What, given these conditions, what can the facility do? How do they handle this? And to what extent are they committed to something like person-centered care? You know, what can they do in individual accommodations to make things better for you or your family member, as the case may be? I think it's important to have that conversation, see what their answers are, and if their answers are, what are you talking about? Individual accommodations, are you out of your mind? If they don't recognize that concept at all, then that's helpful information, and maybe suggests that they're not operating with the best philosophies in mind.
So this is Chris. I'm speaking with Eric Carlson, directing attorney from Justice in Aging. You're at KZFR Community Radio. We are going to run out of time, so I want to cut to you being a member of the Commission for Safety and Quality in Nursing Homes, a federal commission that was called during the pandemic. In January 2021, you were the sole dissenting voice to the report that came out from the commission on the grounds it didn't require CMS to hold nursing facilities accountable for poor care in dangerous conditions. Can you talk about your dissenting voice? What were the key issues involved, and has anybody listened to you?
I think so. Not everybody's listening to me. It's part of the process. There was this 25-member commission appointed by the federal government. This came from the president, the vice president, set up by a government contractor.
A little louder, please.
Yeah, I'm sorry. So the commission issued this report. Most of the recommendations were okay to a certain extent. I dissented because there wasn't much in the report, in the recommendations, that was required from nursing facilities themselves. They were just a lot of instructions or suggestions to the federal government, but without any requirement of accountability for the nursing facilities themselves, in large part because a lot of the members of this commission were linked with the provider community, with nursing facilities themselves, so they were not inclined to impose obligations on themselves, and instead the report skewed heavily towards pointing the finger at the federal government and giving the facilities a pass to a great extent. Do I think people listen to me? Yes, yeah, some did. It's an ongoing process. I feel glad that I made the points that I did. I think it was important that report didn't go out without dissent, because there was a lot that was flawed about it, and It's an ongoing process to communicate, to reach listeners like your audience here on the individual level, as to how people communicate with individual facilities on behalf of individual consumers, and then continue to make these arguments at the state government level and at the federal government level. And I'd like to say, over my many years, I like to say things have gotten better. They're not fixed by any means, and they're not nearly where they should be. But I want to say that bit by bit, there's a balance here. Are things good? No, they're not. There's a tremendous amount of work to be done. But I also want to think that the advocacy work that I and other people have done, and the work that you're doing by communicating this information, has a positive impact, and I do honestly believe that I can see improvements. But it's important for all of us at the advocacy level, at the resident level, at the provider level, to carry the right message and to not put up with substandard care.
Mm. And, you know, I should be letting you go, but I wanted to ask you because my next guest is going to be talking about the unhoused people of our community, and many of them are elderly. We have something called Project Room Key right now that is got about 40 people in it. During the winter, we had a program called Safe Space, and we took in some elderly disabled people, and it is very hard to imagine them on the street. In wheelchairs and with different diagnoses. But is there anything on the federal level that is going to help with unhoused elderly who are just, there's more and more of them all the time?
You know, I'll tell you, that's probably outside my area of expertise. Your other guest is probably going to know it better than I do. I am not familiar with the federal policy in that area, so I don't think I can add much to that conversation.
Well, I appreciate you just even saying that, but it's the next frontier, I guess. But getting housing over people. And thank you, Eric Carlson, for everything you're doing. I would refer people to the Justice in Aging website. Again, the 25 Common Nursing Home Problems and How to Resolve Them is on there. And I'm going to post some of the articles that your colleague sent me. There's been some horrific situations that people should be aware of during COVID. And there's so much information. And I thank you for being an expert on it all. Thank you, Eric.
My pleasure. I've enjoyed speaking with you.
All right. Peace to you. Bye. All right. So I shouldn't have asked him that last question, I guess. You know, there's so many issues we didn't get to, like equity and all of it. There's just reams of stuff here. It was just like a walk down a very, very crowded space when I was reading all this. However, it's going to happen to all of us eventually. And a lot of the baby boomers now have kind of shifted things as our time has come. We shifted the whole situation with labor and childbirth and with education, and hopefully we'll be able to shift some of these places where human beings are warehoused when they get old. Frankly, they are, to me, really horrible places, and it needs to change. People have a right to quality of life and to live out their lives in dignity and with beauty, and, you know, to be really, really respected. And that's really not happening, at least in the experiences I've had as a nurse. And I want to move on to our final guest. I want to let you know beforehand, though, before I put on the next song, is that Concerned Citizens for Justice is having a Say Their Name event on Memorial Day, May 31st, in memory of George Floyd's death. Meet at 10 a.m. at the 1 Mile Bridge. You can come and make and hold a sign. There will be materials provided, though. So in honor of all those who have died so unnecessarily, this is a Phil Oakes song for our martyrs.
In the state of Mississippi, many years ago, a boy of 14 years got a taste of Southern law. He saw his friend a-hanging, his color was his crime, and the blood upon his jacket put a brand upon his mind. Too many martyrs and too many deaths, too many lies, too many empty words were said. Too many times for too many angry men. Oh, let it never be again. His name was Medgar Evers, and he walked his road alone, like Emmett Till and thousands more whose names we'll never know. They tried to burn his home and they beat him to the ground, but deep inside they both knew what it took to bring him down. Too many martyrs and too many deaths, too many lies, too many empty words were said. Too many times for too many angry men. Oh, let it never be again. The killer waited by his home, hidden by the night, as Evers stepped out from his car into the rifle sight. He slowly squeezed the trigger, the bullet left his side. It struck the heart of every man when Evers fell and died. Too many martyrs and too many deaths. Too many lies, too many empty words were said. Too many times for too many angry men. Oh, let it never be again. And they laid him in his grave while the bugle sounded clear. Laid him in his grave when the victory was near. While we waited for the future, for freedom through the land, the country gained a killer and the country lost a man. Too many martyrs and too many deaths. Too many lies, too many empty words were said. Too many times for too many angry men. Oh, let it never be again. Oh, let it never be again.
Again and again and again, never. So, let's see. Nancy Wirtz, I think I have you on the phone. You describe yourself as a mother of six, three by birth and three by adoption. When you told your dad as a child that you wanted to be a social worker, he said, all women are social workers. You need something else to earn a living. So you became a math teacher and then became this a parent of this diverse family, and you've been volunteering your whole life, working for peace and justice in various ways, depending on where you found empathetic folks gathered. So it was Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, the Children's Home Society, the Salvation Army. You've marched against racism and war. You've started the Community Thanksgiving when you lived in Monterey. And now you volunteer with Safe Space, and you're on the board of directors of Safe Space. And you do amazing work, and I well, let's talk about it. Hi, Nancy.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah. Well, you know, we've been part of the same team of advocates now for a long time now, it seems like. I mean, this since January, since the evictions started, there have been people that have come together in order to work towards sheltering for all, and you've been very, very important in all of that. And maybe we should just start off by talking about how you got involved locally, a little bit about Safe Space, what it is, and a lot of people know what it is, but let's just review it in case we have new listeners.
Okay. I was living in Paradise until the fire, and my house was leveled. So I really wanted to be in Chico at that point anyway, because it did seem to me that Paradise was somewhat removed from the real world, and Chico was very real to me, that we deal head on with the real problems that society has to deal with now. And So I jumped in and joined Patrick Newman's group of on the street. I don't know why I stayed on that full name, but anyway,
Chico Friends of the Street. Yeah, go ahead.
So I started bringing food every Sunday to the plaza, and I set up one. Free ice cream social, because it seemed to me that the separation between the homeless and the housed was artificial, and that we ought to be doing things together. So it was, I also made it, put out a can as a benefit for Safe Space, because I had heard how wonderful Safe Space was. And I knew that was where I wanted any money we raised to go. Well, it was a great success, so we had another one. And following the second one, Deanna Schwab invited me to join the board. and I was thrilled. I still am. What Safe Space does, they've never had a piece of real estate. In the winter, we move from church to church parlor, where any church that'll have us, and over the years, it's been, I believe, 9 years now, that we have been sheltering people on mats, on the floor, with dinner and breakfast provided by volunteers, and probably a maximum of 60 people a night, and seldom fewer than 40. It was always filled to as many people as we could put on the floor. We were very popular because we had a code of conduct, but not requirements to be accepted. If you behaved yourself, you could have a bed. And if you had a pet, you would go to the pet section because some people were not comfortable with pets. If you had a partner, you and your partner could have mats next to each other. It was very accepting of people's individuality without allowing any negative behavior. The one thing you would be asked to leave for was any act of violence, whether it be verbal or physical, that would make people feel frightened. And we did on occasion have to ask someone to leave. It was usually verbal, but after 3 days away, they were invited to try again. Because we know everybody's doing the best they can, and our best varies. So we need to give credit to people for what they are doing and not focus so badly on the fact that some of them drink, some of them even do drugs. We don't know what they've been through. We don't know what they're dealing with. And as long as they behave themselves, we'll be there for them.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good description. You bring back a lot of good memories of years with Safe Space. Now, this winter was a total upset because of COVID, and you know, we had to have far fewer people, and it turned out to be just people who were medically compromised. Can you talk a little bit about this winter?
Yes. There were fewer churches willing to accept us this winter because their membership was more frightened by COVID. So we set a limit of 30 guests because that would be the maximum in the largest place with the proper separation. And we used beach cabanas, but they're not cabanas. They're kind of a resting tent, half tent, that you put the head of your sleeping bag in, and it covers maybe as far as your waist, so that if you cough or sneeze, you're in your little half tent. And those were spaced according to CDC guidelines. And we had only people who were particularly vulnerable and who had been in some sort of medical facility beforehand so that they were tested. We knew they didn't have COVID coming in, yeah, which meant we couldn't serve anywhere near the numbers that we did before, but we could provide more services. And in fact, Safe Space still is keeping on our case manager, who is helping the people who stayed with us during the winter to get into permanent housing, which thrilled us, because these were folks who never should have been without permanent housing.
No, they are very fragile people, extremely disabled. And so I'm very appreciative for that, to hear that the case manager is still there. I want to talk about a little bit during this temporary restraining order that is in place until at least June 11th about your work, Nancy Wirtz. And we're here at KZFR talking to Nancy Wirtz from Safe Space. I have seen you in action. The last time was you were at Comanche Creek with, probably
a lot of water.
Probably about over $100 worth of water jugs and gallon-sized containers, giving them out to individual campers. Tell us about your individual work at Comanche Creek and why do you do it?
Well, water has always been a problem at Comanche Creek. There is a water fountain by the parking lot, and it has typically had a low flow, but the patients there have used a cup to gather water, pour it in their jugs so they can take it back to their tent. So I asked Safe Space if we could take water there, and Safe Space, in fact, does fund the water. And I buy 50 gallons at a time, or maximum 60, simply because I can't manage more than 60. But I went twice the day you saw me, because by the time I got halfway through the park, all the water was gone, because at that point the water had been turned off because people had broken into the water line because they wanted more water. And everything is a shade of gray. It was a bad thing to break into it, but they didn't see any other options, and I'm sorry about that. Anyway, at this point, the water fountain has been repaired. There is water there.
Good.
We are bringing water, not every day anymore, because now that they have the water fountain, they can refill a jug. In fact, it has a better flow than it's ever had before. I'm bringing personal wipes. We took them disinfecting wipes back when we were worried about COVID. Well, now what they need is a way to keep clean, and they always needed it, but we didn't know it. Those are like gold. People are so thrilled to be able to get a package that they can wipe themselves wherever they feel dirty.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing is they mustn't put them in the porta-potties, because we also provide a couple of porta-potties, because one was not enough, but three seems to be. And I check them every day for extraneous things like rubbish, because there are, in every society, there are a few scofflaws, and they drop things in the porta-potties, and Safe Space gets dinged with a fee anytime they find something that doesn't belong there.
Mm.
So I spend a lot of time over there, so I've gotten to know people, and I know some really nice people who would be my friends forever if they hang around, because they are just good people who don't have a lot of money.
Right.
Don't get me on a rant about how our society works so hard to put people in castes, really. And people with no money are the untouchable caste in our country. And people are afraid of them. Well, I feel safer in that camp than I feel anywhere, because there are a lot of people. If I got in trouble, dozens would come to help me, or each other, because they do look out for each other. They are good neighbors, except for the few who steal and put trash in the porta potties.
Right.
They're everywhere.
Yeah, and it's so easy to lump homeless people together and to make broad assertions about them being service resistant or any of the other things that you hear. What are you thinking about this next period in terms of where this is going to go with the city of Chico. I know that advocates have been very involved in trying to offer suggestions to the city of Chico in order for them to comply with the judge's order to stop the punishing demands on unhoused people. What are you thinking would be an ideal situation for the short term when there's no housing for people, and an ideal campground for people experiencing homelessness, Nancy Wirtz?
Okay, well, I have to face the fact that it will probably be quite a long time before that dreamed about campground comes about, because they haven't even picked a place yet. And I understand that today they are meeting with quite a few developers and builders who will help them decide where to put this. Now, I think developers and builders will be looking for what is the least desirable place for them to develop or build, and let's put them there. So I hope that it's a congenial place, because just because people don't have houses doesn't mean they don't need to be able to get to the store, take care of their needs. Some of them have jobs. They just can't make enough to rent a place here. And they need access to transportation. So where it gets situated will be very important. Also, it will need to be community friendly, by which I mean that the homeless will be encouraged or placed in more than one locale, even if it's all in one big space, so that they can develop smaller communities. One of the things I'm seeing at Comanche is it's increasing in population,
right,
even as we speak. And the pressure that puts on everybody is visible. There's more mess. People don't recognize each other's faces. It's not as safe feeling as it is when people know each other. So we're hoping that the city will just let Comanche Creek stay there, because they don't have any place yet for people to go. They will have to provide something more stable than tents, because the state won't give money if it's a tent camp. They have to have small buildings with heat and air, which really raises the price of doing that and makes it difficult. But there is money from the state. The city of Chico just gave almost $300,000 to CHAT, and CHAT says they will be doing management, but they will not be on the ground there. But another $583,000 is available for temporary sheltering. Safe Space has applied, and it looks like we hope to be willing to run the campground. We'll have to wait and see what sort of requirements and limitations are placed on it. But we have so much experience in dealing with people as they are and respecting them as they are.
Yeah.
And asking them what they need instead of telling them what they need, because people know what they need, and nobody wants to be homeless. The few people who want to be wanderers are not our concern. The folks at Comanche Creek are not wanderers. They're people who would love to have stable housing, but they can't afford it. And most of them, if they weren't disabled when they became homeless, being homeless is a disabling condition. It's really hard to deal with the big wide world when you don't have a safe place to live and your stuff is never safe. It's just so discombobulating. I can't imagine living like that. I just had some renovation done in my house, so I've been in little tiny spaces because I was getting a new floor, which meant all the furniture had to come out of the living spaces. Oh, my goodness. I was discombobulated. It's just really hard. I didn't have a kitchen. I had to make a camp kitchen for myself. But I still had a bed and a roof and a door. These folks don't even have that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard to... It's hard if you're not involved in this to really understand and to empathize for what people are going through. But it is a human rights crisis, and it is it can't be allowed to continue because we're all human beings, and we all need to be part of the solutions. And I was happy when the mayor and this little ad hoc committees were formed in order to discuss, you know, the best possible campground. But I have a feeling from our city council that they are going to do their utmost to make it as stringent, unlivable, unkind, you know, as possible.
Yeah.
And they're kind of dooming themselves to failure just by their own political closed-mindedness. I hate to say that, but it seems to be true, and you probably agree with me. But what I mean by that, a lot of rules in the campgrounds, a lot of security that people would be very abrasive, not being able to be low barrier, which means that people who were using drugs or alcohol would not be able to be there. Problems with people not being able to have their dogs nearby them and with them. You can mention some more, Nancy, but some of the things that might be restricted if we are not careful.
Well, I went to one of the meetings. It was of representatives of the various nonprofits. And, you know, having a pack of unleashed dogs is an issue, and having the outside world allowed in without fences is a problem, because it isn't only the people who live there who are thieves or rabble-rousers. So we talked a lot about that, and I don't know how the city council felt about it all, but we all agreed that smaller is better, and I know the city prefers larger, so that's why I'm hoping for smaller pods, we'll call them, within a larger one, if there is. And we do need to be protected so that when people come in, they come in through one gate, not just all sides. So people leave through the same gate, so there is not major theft going on. If we already have two shelters that only keep people when they're sober, we need a place for people to go who do like to drink, as most people outside the shelters do. And especially, especially these folks are under stress. Anyway, my expectation is that it will be low barrier, because it won't make sense if it isn't. And I'm getting better at making noise. We'll make a lot of noise if it's too tightly wrapped. One thing that we are concerned about is that the people on city council think that 30, 60, 90 days ought to be enough for a homeless person to recover from their trauma, which is nowhere near reasonable. People are staying at tourist shelter for an average of 300 days before they're ready and able to get into stable housing. Our folks will need the same. It will vary from individual to individual, but we need to convince the city council that people need to be safe long enough to heal. And what will happen in this campground is healing.
Yeah. And we want to help them do that.
Yeah, and the other thing is about the temperatures in Chico. I appreciate the fact that you would like them to stay at Comanche because it's shaded. And in that sense, it's a good spot. And whatever the city does, you know, we have to remember that it gets so hot here in the summer and that it's just unbearable and sometimes to be in the sun. And Nancy Wirtz, I'm just going to refer people to some Facebook pages, which are Stand Up for Chico, Team Chico mm-hmm. Paradise, Butte County Shelter for All. Those are ones that you can get involved with. There's a cleanup tomorrow at Tykert Ponds, which is another place that people have been congregating. That's Saturday at 9. I'm not sure how that's going to go, but that is happening. And I wanted to give you the last word about Safe Space. Do you want to promote Safe Space?
Well,
how to get people to donate?
I for sure do. We're on Facebook, and we accept donations through PayPal. We also accept checks, and darn, I didn't bring the address with me. But come out and meet your homeless neighbors. You'll find me there if it's at the plaza on Sundays. I take sandwiches to Tykert and to Comanche on Sundays as well. There are a lot of people who volunteer. We need all the help we can get because this problem is not going away by itself. And the people we've elected to power don't really want to solve it. They want to make it go away.
Right.
And those of us who care about humanity need to step up and say, not in my town.
Yeah.
We need to be there for them.
Thank you, Nancy.
We'll be there.
Thank you, Nancy Wirtz, for everything you're doing. And please watch your health. Take care of yourself, okay?
We all try. Thank you for inviting me.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, so we're going to be going to Playing Dead here in a minute. I want to do a little real quick forward promote for Touch of Chico, which is an event that we normally have every year in person with massages, but check this out.
KZFR's Touch of Chico is pleased to bring you Uplift Community, a two-part series featuring inspiring local healers and educators, including Malama McNeil, speaking on mind-body medicine, plus talented artists and musicians, including the soulful sounds of Gravy Brain, coming together to uplift you and the community.
For the last 5 years, we've organized KZFR's Touch of Chico together.
Uplift Community is a fundraiser offering for the community and as a benefit for KZFR, your community radio station. Please go to www.kzfr.org.
Enjoy Uplift Community on our YouTube channel on Sunday, May 23rd.
All right. And that YouTube channel is getting to be pretty interesting. Lots of good stuff there. So hope you'll check it out. Also, I want to thank our underwriters before I leave today. I'd like to thank Digital Path, providing high-speed internet for your home or business. Digital Path offers flexible plans with expanded data and speeds up to 75 megabytes per second. Details about Digital Path service at 800-676-PATH. That's 800-676-7284 and at digitalpath.net. And by Burchard Construction, providing custom remodels, new home and commercial building, from fountain to finish. Burchard Construction, where the homeowner's input matters. Custom construction with beauty and function. Bids and consultations are available at 864-5427 or at burchardconstruction.com. So stay tuned for Playing Dead. I'm going to give you the community calendar. I hope you all stay well and have peace in your lives. 1 second here. Got to get to the right place. All right. Take care, friends.
Hey, listeners. It's time for the KZFR 90.1 FM community calendar with me, Megan Hammer. Butte County Office of Education's Children's Centers has openings in their preschool programs. Children's Center Preschool offers free, high-quality preschool in Chico, Gridley, Oroville, and Ridge communities.
Children's Center's preschool provides part-day programs for children 3 and 4 years of age. Preschool is a fun way for your child to learn new skills and make friends while preparing them for kindergarten. To learn more, call 530-532-5643 or visit www.cdps.bcoe.org. The SYRCO, South Yuba Citizens League, needs River Ambassador volunteers to help to effectively implement their program for river cleanup and preparation for the influx of visitors this summer. This is why the SYRLC is recruiting 70 to 100 volunteers to be river ambassadors at the South Yuba River this summer, on weekends from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. starting May 29th and running through September. COVID-safe protocols will prioritize the health and well-being of volunteers. The first online training will be Wednesday, May 12th from 6 p.m. to 7:30. For more information and to sign up for volunteer dates, visit yubariver.org. If you have an event you'd like on the community calendar, let me know by sending us an email at cc@kzfr.org. This is the KZFR 90.1 FM Community Calendar.
Alrighty, and it's just a minute, just about a minute after 1 o'clock. My name's Ray. I'll be your host today for Playing Dead, Music of the Grateful Dead, every Friday afternoon. I got a fun show for you. 1980, classic 80, 515, 1980, Nassau Coliseum, starting off with a really nice, strong Jack Straw, Franklin's Tower to get you kicking in. So stay tuned for that. Beautiful second set. Just a nice, solid show, man. Totally. All righty, let's thank our underwriters. Affordable Automotive, repairing and maintaining all makes of cars, trucks, and SUVs since 1996. Affordable Automotive has pickup, delivery service, and financing available at 2106 Park Avenue. Appointments at 892-1774 and at chicoautomotive.com. And they're also looking for new technicians. To join the team, if you're interested, you can reach Mike Button at 892-1774. We want to thank Quicksilver Courier Service, established in 2010. Quicksilver Courier Service has the flexibility to provide a broad range of delivery services. Quicksilver provides courier service for private individuals as well as legal, medical, and business professionals. Visit chicocourier.com for quality 24/7 delivery service. All righty, as promised, let's get right to it. Got a nice full show for you. Just a nice solid 80s show. So check it out. Go to the Playing Dead at KZFR Facebook page. Throw me a like. I'll get you a shout out. Got some nice pictures from the show up there, as well as the complete set list is already up on the site. All right, let's do it.